I'll tell you what I'm inclined to do here. I'm inclined to continue touching kind of experientially and poetically on the remaining mansions. Then I would like to share some suggestions on how to read a mystic, like contemplative Lectio Divina. And I would also like to share, like I did with Merton, I'd like to share here with Teresa, again, a suggestion for the practice of praying this way. What's a form of praying that offers the least resistance to this unitive state so that we can then live this way and then have our jokes, contemplative jokes, and then the questions, and we'll end by four, maybe end before four. We'll see how it goes. How's that sound? Okay, get back now into the mansions. See, let's say it's very clear that Teresa is talking about something and trying to share something that she has experienced at a very deep level that has transformed her life. And it's also clear that she's trying to help people who are being interiorly led along this path, because she realizes that trustworthy guidance on this inner path is not easy to find, if you've noticed. See? And so she's especially helpful because, like Goigo in A Ladder for Monks, in my book I did on Christian meditation, the chapter A Ladder to Heaven is a commentary on Goigo, the second A Ladder for Monks. But Goigo, A Ladder for Monks, and Teresa are the two mystics that start at the very beginning of the journey. A lot of the other mystics kind of assume you're already in the midst of this psychological, spiritual maturity, and so on. They kind of start right in with where you are, with passage through a dark night, or whatever the metaphor of the mystic is. And so she starts at the beginning, the first three mansions. And basically, I think what Teresa does for this is this. Teresa understands the importance of building strong foundations in psychological, spiritual maturity. We were talking about this at the very end. It's not that you cannot be granted very deep mystical realizations without those foundations, but you'll lack the psychological foundations to support the depth and breadth of that mystical experience. And so she talks about the importance of doing your homework and patiently building these foundations as holiness itself. A mystic is not more holy than another person. The mystic is just deeply aware of how unexplainably holy everybody is. And she talks about that. Next, she's trying to help people understand. She understands how confusing it can be to realize you're being led by God. Beyond the frontiers of thought, beyond the frontiers of feeling, beyond the frontiers of comprehension, beyond the frontiers of structure. She knows this is very hard to do this. And so with the fourth mansion, she's trying to help people in kind of a contemplative epistemology, a contemplative guidance, and to realize that, you know, if the shoe fits, wear it. You know, if you resonate with this, you know, to realize this applies to you. Maybe this applies to you. And she knows how hard it is to be a good beginner, namely to ground yourself in humility, to ground yourself in prayer, and to ground yourself in experiential self-knowledge and daily life. She also knows now fifth and sixth mansion, fifth and sixth. She also knows how hard it can be to be midpoint in the journey. You've come so far. You can't go back. What are you going to go back to, really? And you don't know how to move on. See, that you're midpoint in an arc of the metamorphosis of the foundations of your very subjectivity, and how to conduct yourself in this with courageous prudence and patience and compassion and so on. And in the seventh mansion, sixth and seventh, she knows what it's like to begin to realize that the consummation of your longings are imminent, and how not to be afraid, and to be able to discern what's happening to you. And so you have to imagine yourself sitting in spiritual direction with her. And so it's heart to heart. You know, it's a lived experience, sitting with someone. I saw a lovely video of Isaac Perlman teaching violin to gifted young students. And what Perlman would do is he'd ask the student to play something. And Perlman would listen, and he would stop the person, and he would say, so you ask, well, what is Perlman listening for? What's he listening for? One, he's listening for to what extent did the person do their homework and the refinement of their technique. And Perlman would then play some phrases on the violin and ask the person to play it. And he's looking for the person's ability to be malleable, to kind of take on and learn something. But he's listening for something else. He's listening for the something that undefinable something, see, because of the soul of the artist. Like, what is that kind of ecstatic, unnameable something? And so when you have a mystic for a spiritual director, what's the spiritual director listening for? See, clearly they're listening for mental health, sanity. You know, the spiritual director is that person in your life to ask, you know, how are things at home? Have you eaten lately? That is, if you're going to become a mystic, you should do your best not to become unnecessarily odd. See? You should be, because you're just being yourself. You're just, for you, this isn't odd at all. It may be atypical, but it's not odd for you. It'd be odd not to do this for you. And to what extent is the person listening for your fidelity of surrendering to something you don't understand, and you don't understand how to surrender to it, and it's metamorphosizing the foundations of your consciousness? And how do we do this? Like, where are you at with this? And so in that spirit, then, I'll join in, we'll kind of round out this thing. So let's put it this way. And here I'm being influenced by, there's this lovely book by Mary Froelich, Froelich, The Intersubjectivity of the Mystic, A Study of Teresa of Avila's Interior Castle, and it's based on the thought of Bernard Larnagan. She uses the phenomenology of consciousness in Bernard Larnagan to clarify Teresa of Avila. And so I'm being influenced by that as I say this right here. So let me put it this way. Let's do it this way. Let's say that we're living our life in intentional consciousness, in our search for meaning, illumined by faith. So we aspire to understand God's will for us. We understand, we seek with God's help to be true to God's will for us, to be transformed in it, to live as God would have us live through the gospel. We seek to open our hearts to God in prayer and prayerful reflection and meditation and petition and all of that. She says, but understand, and this is holiness on this earth, but this is not our ultimate destiny. See, our ultimate destiny in death, when the veil parts, see, God will be all in all. That our destiny is an infinite union with the infinite forever as the ultimate consummation of God's will for us. And that you can, by God's will, being invited to live that way now. And so the fourth mansion then begins a kind of quieting of the faculties of the soul. So the thinking self and all that it thinks, the remembering self and all that it remembers, the desiring self and all that it desires, the sensory self and all that the senses perceive, are being quietly brought to the end of what they're capable of, so that your ego, illumined by faith, ceases to be the base of operations in what's happening to you. And in that kind of quiet, that you're kind of, something in you is secretly drawn to the boundaries of human capabilities, and you're drawn into an aura, a transformed subjectivity. And so this thing about the sweetness of prayer, you realize your heart's being enlarged to divine proportions. And in realizing thought is being grounded in understanding, and the understanding is being grounded in a deeper way to understand what it means to understand, that you begin to understand the deep things of God in a way that cannot be adequately expressed in conceptual terms. I know it, I know it, I know that I know it. The trouble is, it's I who know that I know it. And when I try to tell you what it is that I know, I don't know what to say. See, but it has been given to me in childlike simplicity to come to a certain kind of radical clarity that I don't know quite how to articulate here. But I can tell it means everything to me. It's God's will for me to follow this. And this is fourth mansion. And then in that fourth mansion, in that aura of quiet, you circle back around into the first three mansions, but they're leavened by the richness of the fourth mansion. That is, you're just talking with a friend, you're just talking, but you're given a heightened awareness for the sacred nature of a simple conversation with a friend, that it has a certain stature to it that cannot be comprehended, you know. And you take on a heightened appreciation for ordinary things because your heart's being illumined by the fourth mansion metamorphosis that filters back down through the first three mansions, fifth mansion. Let's say you're living this way, more or less, as we are. I know we are. The fifth mansion is the example she used. And save time, I won't read the text. I'll paraphrase them. So and this is the image of the caterpillar in the fifth mansion. She says, "Sisters, imagine how amazing it is that a caterpillar, a silkworm, spins a cocoon, and it disappears from our finite eyes. And an amazing thing happens. It comes out a butterfly." See? So she says, you're sitting there, and she's, what you're doing, you're sitting there, and first you're in reflective prayer. You're in this, you're talking to God, God talking to you. It goes into that fourth mansion aura of quiet, of this kind of deep understanding with your heart enlarging. It's like that quiet, kind of sweet, kind of like that. And then you get to a point where you lose the ability to sustain awareness of yourself and reflective consciousness, and you disappear from yourself. See? You disappear from yourself. See, it isn't just that we exist, but we know we exist. It isn't just that we're going to die someday. We know we're going to die someday. We hold ourselves up in our mind's eye, and we have feelings about ourselves. Certain things about ourselves we're proud of. Certain things about ourselves we're ashamed of. The trouble is, see, my self. So the self of myself is the self I worry about. See? It's the self I've come to conclusions about. I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. Because of you, I walk the line. But it goes, because I fell into a burning ring of fire. Down, 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 the flames went hard. A ring of fire. And so you're watching all this happen. See? And you're being transformed in love, and you're reflecting on the process. But then there's a certain moment then of quiet, but you're still in the fourth mansion, able to maintain conscious, reflective consciousness of yourself in that kind of transparent, lucid awareness infused with love. Does that make sense in a way? You're still there in a reflective consciousness of yourself, but in the fifth mansion, like the caterpillar disappearing from view, you disappear from your finite eyes. She said, this state of vanishing away may last just for a few minutes. She said it might last longer. And when you return, you don't know whether anything happened or not because you weren't there. See, there are no witnesses to it. It's not meant for finite eyes. It is not meant for finite eyes. She says, but you know something happened because you reappear as a butterfly with tattered wings. See, a butterfly with tattered wings. This is not the beloved. This is not the beloved. This is not the beloved. See? That everything here is infinitely less than the one thing that is enough for me. You know, stranger in a strange land. See? So like the widow walking through the house after the death of her husband, in an empty house filled with things, you fill with the whole world and everything in it is infinitely less than the infinite beloved that is in secret drew you through and drew you into an infinite union with the infinite and returned you back to yourself and able to live on your own terms. And yet she says, you've never been happier in your whole life, she says. So this fifth mansion then is a state, and here I want to put this way, it's a state of bare awareness, but you're not aware of anything. And there's no intentions. There's no intentions in it. There's no content of the consciousness. It's like a luminous, transparent field of luminous emptiness of subjectivity. The extraordinary thing is, you discover the infinite ground of consciousness itself, which is God. The infinite ground of consciousness itself is welling up and giving itself as your very consciousness. That is, the infinite ground of consciousness is the infinity of the most intimate reality of yourself. See, like that. I want to give an image of this. Imagine a stone falling in water. Imagine a stone falling in water. And the stone is falling, 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 falling. And imagine that the water in which the stone is falling is bottomless. It's bottomless. And so the stone is falling forever. Falling, falling, falling. And imagine that the water, the bottomless depths, the water, the stone is falling alongside an underwater cliff. And there's protrusions on this cliff. And every so often the stone lands on one of those protrusions and it momentarily pauses in its descent. See? And then in the undulations of the water, the movements of the water, it rolls off again and it falls until the next time it pauses. And it goes on bottomlessly falling forever. And imagine you are that stone. And imagine we're all sitting here together falling into God forever. And every so often we land somewhere. We say, you know, I think I'll get a degree in something. And maybe buy a car and get a house. And hell, I'll get married and have some kids and plant some flowers. And I think I'll stay here for a while. See? And the love gets unmanageably beautiful, or a child dies, or some unexpected thing happens. And you realize you cannot live on your own terms, and you go rolling off. And down you go, falling, falling, falling. And then you pause again somewhere. See, you know, boy, you get your bearings. I think I'll stay here for a while. This is pretty good. I think I got the hang of it. This is pretty good. You know, and off you go again, falling, falling, falling. See. Imagine two people who love each other very, very much. And she says to him, you know, before we met, I didn't even know love like this even existed. And he says, me either. I didn't know it either. And she says, I suppose if we keep going this way, it'll get deeper. He says, I suppose that it will. And she says, I wonder If we'll ever get to a depth of love so deep, there'll be no deeper depth of love beyond the depth of love we got into. He says, you've gone off your medications again, haven't you? See what she's asking, really? See, is there an end to love? See, is there an end to love? I wonder if we'll ever get to a depth of love so deep that there's no deeper depth of love beyond the depth of love, and they'll never, never get to it forever. See? Next. What if in asking that question, she intimately realizes that the bottomless abyss of love into which they're making their descent is welling up and completely giving the infinity of its bottomless depths away as that very moment of their loving encounter right at that moment, holding hands, saying this to each other. See? That this is really returning from the fifth mansion into the sixth mansion. The sixth mansion is a state. It is a state of realizing that one has entered into a bottomlessness that has no name. You disappear from yourself. There are no words for it. There are no names for it. There's nothing to it. And you, when you return back a butterfly with tattered wings, you realize that the infinity of God is infinitely giving itself away as the concrete immediacy of the moment that you're sitting here realizing this. See? But it's obscure to you. Imagine you go to the ocean and you're only ankle deep. It's true you're only ankle deep. Just keep going, it'll get plenty deep soon enough. This is clear. But what if the ocean in the middle is infinitely deep? And what if the infinitely deep ocean is infinitely giving the infinitely deep depths of itself away as every degree of entrance into it? You look at two people who've loved each other very deeply for a long time. And they love to talk about how they first met each other. They love to talk about the moments they first realized they were falling in love with each other. They realize how they really were completely unaware what they were getting themselves into. And all the kind of serendipitous cul-de-sacs, some of them very painful, and all the rest of it. In hindsight, they're able to realize they were being infinitely cared for by the love that brought them right to this moment. That is, each incremental degree of entrance into God is itself the infinite depths of God infinitely giving itself away as the first little stirring of entrance into it. And there's the realization of that in yourself. The sixth mansion, then, is where this experience does not become a momentary moment of unit of consciousness, but rather becomes an habitual underlying state by being totally metamorphosized. It's the longest mansion in the book. And in effect, what she says are things like this. She says that through visions, especially intellectual visions, God translates your mind into God's own mind. And she says that in affect, God translates your libido into infinite love. So that your libidinal energy is the infinite love of God incarnating itself as the libidinal intimate immediacy of your libidinal stirrings for deep to be consummated in love. She also says in the sixth mansion that there's great suffering. And what's really happening is God's weaning you off the ability to function on the earthly plane, as finding your balance in the earthly plane. She says in the sixth mansion, she's the thing about sixth mansion is that it's solitary and that nobody understands you anymore. She says you don't blame them because you don't understand it either. She says some people think you're just a troublemaker. No. That you're just a troublemaker, you think you're more special than other people, and they feel resentment towards you. She said, other people think you're a saint. She says she finds it more troubling when people think she's a saint because they think it's her instead of God. It shows you how different everybody is. I find it more troublesome when people think I'm a troublemaker. But everybody's different. But you realize that there's opinions about yourself, and you have them too, but they do not qualify to what's happening to you. You also see in everybody that they're not qualified to see how unexplainably lovable they all are, the sixth mansion. And she says, in this state then is spiritual betrothal. You get engaged to God in the sixth mansion. See, some people know God. Other people are dating God, but they still want to see other people. Let's not get this too serious here. And then some people get engaged to God. God pops the question to be engaged to God. And she says in the sixth mansion, she says to be engaged to God, she said, imagine there's two candles. Here's God's candle and here's your candle. And they're both burning. And you put the two wicks together and the two flames burn as one flame. And under ideal circumstances, you're in this state of oneness where you and God mutually disappear as other than each other. And then your cell phone goes off. See, it's like this. You take another deep breath, kind of get back like this again. It's like that. She says that in the seventh mansion, which is to be married to God, it's not like that anymore. She said in the seventh mansion, it's like water falling from the sky into the river, and you can no longer tell the water that fell from the sky from the water in the river. And now even your difficulties are God. There's this apocryphal story of Teresa. She's going on one of the foundations, and it was after a major storm, and the rivers were swollen with rushing water, and this horse is carrying the cart up out on the muddy bank of the river, and the wagon tips over, and she falls on her hands and knees in the mud. And she says, God, why are you letting this happen to me? He said, Teresa, this is how I treat my friends. And she says, no wonder you have so few. So, and then you realize that even the problems are infinite, because ultimately speaking, only one thing is happening. Infinite love is giving itself away as the unbearable beauty of the world. Really, like this. She was a visionary. And she was in her cell in the monastery, and a child appeared in her cell. And her name in religion was Teresa of Jesus. And the child appeared in the room, and the child said to her, who are you? She said, I'm Teresa of Jesus. Who are you? He said, I'm Jesus of Teresa. And she said, there's this kind of unbreakable love bond of the trustworthy divine nature of the unfolding complexities of day-by-day life. And she died on the trip to one of her foundations. She got ill. It was a trip she didn't want to make. Really, she was, and it was complicated. And she died on that trip. Teresa of Avila. Now, a way to pray, or a way to read the mystics. To read this. This helps me. Get a copy of The Interior Castle, like this, and get a journal, and read the first paragraph of the prologue, and by hand in your journal, outline it by hand. So you read the first paragraph, Roman numeral 1, what's the topic sentence, indent capital letter A, capital letter B, indent 1, little a, little b. Now in order to outline it, you have to read it. But she had to write it. It's only fair that you read it. And it has an infrastructure. It has an infrastructure to it. It helps to light a candle. It helps. And then after you've outlined the first paragraph or two, put a box on the paper and write how have I or how am I experiencing what she's talking about. Maybe the box will be empty. Undaunted, you move on. Put another box there. And in the next box would be, if I were to say it, how would I say it? Because the best way to learn something is to teach it. If you had to teach The Interior Castle and communicate to people what she says in the first paragraph, how would you say it? And then on the third box, put this question, what is this asking out of me? What is this asking out of me? Then you outline the second paragraph, the third paragraph, time to blow out your candle and go to work. You know, you come back the next morning, light your candle, open up where you left off, and you go through the interior castle like that. It might take 2 years. Go through the whole, you got a lot of journals there. It's been quite a ride, really. And after you finish the last page, take a few weeks off, middle path, you don't want to overdo it, and go back and start all over again. Get a new journal, start with the first paragraph of the prologue, outline it. How have I or am I experiencing? And this time what you write in there will be different because you're different, which is what the book is about, really. It's about you. It's about you. How would you say it? Before you had a big, huge question mark, beats me, and you take a go at it because you're different. You're different. What's it asking out of me might be very different because you're different. And go through the whole book that way. Another 2 or 3 years later. It can also help if you can find a commentary that's as deep as what it's commenting on. In the collected works by the Institute of Carmelite Studies, the introductions are very, very well done, really, where you get in-depth commentaries, outline them, and then go back and read the interior castle again, and repeat until death. To repeat until death. There are certain books you'll never finish because there's no end to them, really. And this is to know the mind of the teacher. It's good to know the mind of the teacher. It's more like a place than a book. And you can pick it up off the shelf like an old friend, open any page and read it out loud, because everything she says counts. Everything she says counts. And she means every word that she says, because it comes right from her heart. Comes right from her heart. So it's good to have your Zen Master Dogen says, find that person whose words awaken your heart with a desire for the great way, and then forget everything else. You kind of walk around with it, keep it under your pillow, walk around like this. And try another mystic, you know, and keep moving onward until senility sets in. So it's good life. Next, would it be good to talk about prayer? Do you feel up to it? Do you feel up to that? Okay. I don't. No, really. I was hoping you'd go, please stop. No, I feel up to it too. Let me just say a word about prayer. Because, really. And then I want to tell my jokes. And we'll have a question. A little thing on prayer, the jokes, and then we'll have questions that'll end at 4. Okay. Here's a way to pray that helps me. This would be sixth mansion prayer. See, what would prayer look like to ground ourselves in these states of unitive consciousness? You'd sit still, you'd sit straight, slow, deep, natural breathing. You'd renew your faith. You're sitting there in the presence of God, all about you and within you, closer to you than you are to yourself. The God who so mysteriously brought you to this very moment of prayer, like this, and become aware of your breathing. Become aware of your breathing. Inhaling, become aware that you're inhaling. Exhaling, become aware you're exhaling. And become grounded in your body. Become grounded in the bodily consciousness of yourself sitting right there. When you inhale, listen to God's silent, I love you, breathing into you the gift of life, loving you into your chair, a love without whom you would be nothing, absolutely nothing. Can you learn to listen so deeply that you can hear God speaking you into being? See? And you breathe in this silent, I love you. God breathed into Adam the gift of life. God's breathing into you this breath. God's breathing herself, reality itself is your very reality. And then when you exhale, exhale yourself in love. Like give yourself in love to the love with the next inhalation that's giving itself to you. And then with the next inhalation, listen to God's silent, I love you. And then silently as you exhale, exhale the silent, I love you, giving yourself in love to the love that's giving itself to you. Your wandering mind around the edges will come and go. Let it. But keep your heart steadfast in this, I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you. Now as you sit there that way, you may notice that you're feeling sad about something. And maybe you have a reason to be sad. And when you inhale, listen to God loving you, sadness and all, Listen to God loving you, sadness and all, into the present moment. And when you exhale yourself in love, give yourself in love, sadness and all, to the love that's giving itself to you, sadness and all. Then imagine you feel stuck in something, kind of scary. You don't know how you're going to get out of it. When you inhale, breathe in God loving you through and through and through, scary, stuckness and all. And when you exhale, give yourself in love, scary, stuckness and all, to the love that's loving you, scary, stuckness and all. Let's say you're in physical pain. Breathe in God loving you through and through and through, pain and all. And give yourself in love, pain and all, to the love that loves you, pain and all. And little by little by little, you can experience for yourself the unsubstantiality of everything but love. Infinite love, in an ongoing act of love, is creating us in the image and likeness of love for love's sake alone. See, this is the reality. In the reciprocity of love, destiny is fulfilled. And by faithfully breathing that way, you can learn to live that way. You can learn to live that way. Stuck in rush hour traffic, going to see a friend in the hospice, sitting there, I love you, I love you, I love you, I love you. How to be sustained by this one thing that's always happening. Now for the jokes. I'll spare you all of them. I'll just share. I was going to say I'll leave out the corny ones, but maybe they're all corny, I don't know. First joke. By the way, I've given retreats before, sometimes for many years, and people come back every year. And there's people that have heard these jokes like 20 times. So here the fields are white for the harvest. You know, this is really a whole new batch of people to try these out on. So here we go. This first one came from New Yorker magazine. And someone wrote on it, this is what it's like listening to your talks. This is a Buddhist monk sitting out in the mountains at night, and he has his back to you. And on the mountain there, on top of the mountain, there's a huge gong, like the size of this church, big, huge gong on top of this mountain. And hovering right above the gong is a full moon. So he's sitting there alone in the forest at night, this big round gong, and then the moon right above the gong. And the monk says, the gong, and this is what it's like listening to my talks. The gong is like the moon, dot, dot, dot. He's letting this sink in how deep it is to say that. Next picture. The moon is like the gong, dot, dot, dot. He's letting that sink in how deep that is to say that. Next picture. The gong and the moon being alike are... oh, hell with it. you wait for the point, you realize there is none. Someone sent this from BC Magazine. They put my name on it and sent it to me. The guy's leaning on the rock. He said, Dr. Finley, where do you get all your wisdom from? He said, each night I travel beyond the frontiers of consciousness into the ground of truth. There's a pause. He said, you know what, Dr. Finley? He said, know what? He said, you're a fruitcake. There's this Hindu yoga teacher teaching Om, chanting Om. And there's this big ashram. So he teaches them the instructions of Om, the tradition of Om. He said, now go out through the forest of the ashram and chant Om all morning. And I'll come around and talk with each one of you about your Om chanting. And there was a lake on the grounds of this property. And a couple hundred yards offshore of this lake, there's a little island. So the meditation teacher's walking along. He sees one of the students sitting on the shore of the island, real loud, going, Om-ma, Om-ma. So the guy yells over. He says, it's not Om-ma, it's Om. And the guy goes, what? He said, it's not Om-ma, it's Om. He said, I said, the guy goes, He stands up and he comes walking over to the teacher on the water. Walks over and says, "I'm sorry, I couldn't hear from over there what you were saying." And the meditation teacher said, "Never mind." There was a Catholic couple, very devout Catholic couple. They met on a retreat. They went to retreats together. It was really the basis of their relationship, their spirituality and their centering prayer and all of it. And they talked about dying and who's going to die first and all this. And they said, half jokingly, half seriously, "Whoever dies first, if possible, see if the person, we can't come back to make contact with the other." So they shook hands on it. A couple years later, the husband was tragically killed in an automobile accident. And a couple years after the death, the young widow was awakened in the middle of the night by a voice calling her name, and she sits up in bed, you know, and she says, "Tom, is that you?" He said, "Yes." Yeah. She said, "Oh my God." She said, "Well, what's it like?" He said, "Well," he said, "we all get up real early in the morning, and we all go down to the river and get a drink. Then we all make love. Then we all eat, and then we take a nap. Then we all go down to the river and get a drink. Then we all make love. Then we all eat, then we take a nap. Then we all go down to the river and get a drink. Then we all make love. Then we all eat, then we take a nap." Then we all, she stops him and says, "Is that what it's like up there?" He said, "Up there, are you kidding? I'm a jackrabbit in Arizona." Last joke, last one. There's a chicken lying flat on her back in a chicken yard with her legs sticking up in the air. And another chicken comes over and says, "What are you doing?" And she says, "I'm holding the sky up." And the other chicken said, "But you can't do that." "Yes, I know," she said, stiffening her legs a little tighter. "But we all have to do the best we can." Are there any questions? Really, about all of this? You know, we last night and all day today, we're about to go home and live this way. You know, hopefully this is renewed and deepened fidelity to this path. Questions, concerns? Yes.
So my question is, can you move between the different mansions? Is that a desirable thing or something that you only want to press forward? Do you understand what I'm asking? Because I'm not sure I do.
I do.
Okay.
Let's put it this way. I understand what I think you're asking, and so I'll respond. Is it that I move from the first mansion into the second? I check that off. I don't have to deal with that anymore. And then I move from the second into the third. But each mansion, each transformative evolution of your mind and heart contains all the previous ones, but is not limited to them. As a matter of fact, Teresa says, when you reach the seventh mansion, your only question left is, how can I be helpful? She says, "Sisters, let's be very careful. We don't imagine we love humanity, and we're judgmental towards the people we live with every day. It always circles back around to what's actually happening in the ordinary unfolding of life. And so all these mansions are actually happening simultaneously as potentialities of divinization through love. And to reach the highest mansion is to reach the mansion that contains all the other mansions, because really it's to reach that state that's none distinct from God, who's infinitely present in our breath, in our body, in our thoughts, and in our life. It's like that. It's just that in relative consciousness of relative reality, at a certain phase of your life, you're primarily in a certain phase of the journey. Does that make sense? You know how you go into the mall and they have the thing, "You are here," and you kind of get a feeling, "I think I'm kind of here right now." And you can kind of tell where you've been, and she's helping you see what possibly lies ahead. But the more you go on, it's more and more inclusive like that.
Uh, How far can you move through the mansions and still hold a regular job?
Teresa of Avila was an administrator and founder of foundations. These foundations were caught in inner political turmoil. And this was during the Inquisition. And there was a lot of complicated church-based politics going on. People trying to stop the reform, trying to get the Pope to condemn the reform, she was into it. You read her book, The Foundations, you see that. Meister Eckhart was the same way. Meister Eckhart was vicar and prior. He was a spiritual director and administrator to Dominican houses throughout Germany. And he was a mystic immersed in the complications of the world, in the complexities of the world. And so this is completely possible like this. Here's what it comes to me about the workplace. And I work with people in corporate stuff and working with this and so on. I was really touched by a book I thought was so spiritual. You know that book, Seven Habits of Highly Effective People? And one of the habits was, he said, this person who's highly effective in the corporate world, when you walk in to be with them, you're the only person in the world right there. They'll tell you right at the beginning, we just have 10 minutes. And at the end of 10 minutes, they stand up. But right where you're right there, they're right there with you. The other person is constantly trying to catch up so they can be present to anything. My wife, she was in international sales in Manhattan and New York for a cosmetic company and all this. And she said the chairman of the board, when he announced he was retiring, people on the board cried with it because he was a man of integrity. He was fair to people. He was a brilliant, committed, grounded person in the midst of the world. So we can do this. We can do this. Yeah. Anyone else with anything? Yes.
Last.
Not now. No. You want mine?
Well, I can hear you, but they can't. This is going to sound like a superficial question, but it's not really. I've heard you describe how to read a book before, and I've tried it, and it doesn't work for me. I get through a single page and I get tired of the outline. Have you ever read a whole book the way you described it?
I've been reading The Interior Castle since I was 18 years old. I've read St. John of the Cross since I was 18 years old. I've been through 3 volumes, they fell apart. Read it over and over and over, and outlined them by hand. I'm cleaning out stuff right now, getting ready for the big move. and literally, I have handwritten drafts of these talks. I have John of the Cross talks, handwritten, pile that high. And when I wrote these for talks, I started all over again, wrote it all out by hand. All over again, opened it up, went through it by hand, sat with it, and every time I do it, it's new for me, I do that. I don't read much. Do I mean I don't read much contemporary things or read much? But this, an in-depth commentaries, and through my work as a psychologist, depth psychology, doing the work of the clinical work, I really try to absorb this and sit with it. But the thing is, that's how it works for me. I've been in contemplative spiritual direction with people, or people, very contemplative, mystical type people in trauma. And they're just not like this. It wouldn't occur to them to do that. And it wouldn't occur to me to suggest that they do it. No. So you try it on for size. If the shoe fits, wear it. If it doesn't, find it. You find your way to do this. That's all that counts, really. Just this helps me this way. Yes.
Last night, you
raise your hand. Oh, I see. Okay, good. Thanks.
Last night, you gave a definition of grace, and I was wondering if you would wait around with a definition of joy.
Yeah. joy is the overflow of grace. That's cheating. I would say. Thomas Merton had an interesting comment about celibacy. And he said the reason a lot of people have trouble with celibacy is they fail to understand the depths from which joy comes from. See? That joy is a kind of a boundaryless happiness beyond the dualism of happiness and sadness. It's not a psychological state of happiness. It's an overwhelming state of liberated joy that includes but is not limited to feelings of happiness. I would say joy is that. And then I would also say God's the infinity of joy. God is joy. And joy is the concrete immediacy of God. Anyone else with anything?
How does one manage this process if the spouse is not on the same journey?
If the spouse is not on the same journey, there's different ways to look at this. Sometimes if you marry someone who's like this too, you're both like this. Seems great. If the spouse is not like this, it's okay as long as the spouse respects you for being like this. As a matter of fact, they tell you one of the things they love about you is you are like this. Often, I will work with people who are like this, whose spouse is not like this, and they realize their spouse is as much or more spiritual than they are. More honest, more loving, more patient, and so on. And what they love about that person is that person's way of being spiritual. If the person is demeaning towards this, or judgmental towards this, or threatened by this, it can be deeply problematic to the person. When this happens, I think there's two things to consider. One, you want to be very sure that you're not acting in ways that are contributing to that person's difficulties and being threatened by this. That is, that you're not using this as a rationale for avoiding being intimate with the beloved, each unto each, meeting each other. You want to be sure you're not doing that, et cetera, et cetera. Let's say you're not, then there's another side to all this, and I'll just put it however the person would say it. I'll say it as if you're talking to the person. You know, there's something I want to talk with you about. You know what it is, this thing about my spirituality? I think you're prejudiced towards it. Prejudice is a negative feeling toward a person or a group about whom you have no real knowledge. And you don't show any interest in even learning what it's about, but feel very free in saying very hurtful things about it. It doesn't feel good, and I'm going to ask you to stop. Don't do that anymore, please. I'd also encourage you, you might not want to. It would mean the world to me if you'd sincerely try to understand it better. Just take one thing or come to something, because I know you love me, and I'm this way. I don't want you, I'm not asking you to be this way. I'm seriously not. But I don't get where the toxic energy comes from, on what tripwire this is hitting in you. I don't know if you understand it either. But I'm asking you to not do it anymore. With us, this has not worked with me. Please don't do it. And I'd like to talk with you about this. And you see it through with the person. In my first marriage, it ended in divorce. It was complicated, but at the very heart of it, this was a big piece of it, really. And so, anyway, that's that. Yes.
Last night you spoke of grace, as he just mentioned. Would you mind repeating what you said about grace?
About grace?
Grace.
You got to realize, I'm making this up as I go along, in a way, and I often don't remember what I said, but let me try. Sometimes it sticks, you know, it's Grace. Tell me if this comes close, Grace. Is that I have been accessed by a mystery which has deeply blessed me. And I know not what to make of it. I know not what to make of it. The book I wrote, The Contemplative Heart, the opening paragraph goes this way. A seeker is someone for whom a grace has engendered a riddle. The grace is that it's just simply given, like birth, like love, like this. The riddle is I know not what to make of it. I know not what to make of it. I turned a corner, and I was granted something I did not see coming, really. And it was given to me. It was given to me. And it's asking something out of me. It's asking out of me that I be faithful to the grace that was given, that I bear witness to it like that. I would answer grace that way. Yeah. Gregory of Nyssa, he talks about glory unto glory, the Greek father of the church. And I'll paraphrase. He's after you've been in heaven for a trillion years. You're finally getting the hang of it. You know, all the angels on a first name basis. God pulls a lever and eternity starts all over again. Amen. See? And grace is being left with the intimacy of being endlessly surprised by the intimate immediacy of that for which you cannot find no words. You might stammer it out as I love you. Or you might stammer it out as I thank you. Or you might stammer it out as like obediential fidelity to being true to what's given to you. And to be willing to pay the price. You know, T.S. Eliot, toward the end of his life, four quartets, he said, sometimes I regret having been a poet. The price was too high. And we thank our lucky stars he paid the price, because there's a price to pay for fidelity to the grace. It asks everything of us, everything. But unless you respond with generosity, you know you're not being who you're invited to be, you know, which is the grace of your journey, whether it be loving somebody or your children or the ministry, whatever it is. I'll share this little story comes to mind. A priest was once giving a homily at the liturgy at the retreat, and he worked with developmentally challenged children. And he said one of the things that they do is, and the parents bring their child to the session, and they're sitting off watching this. He said they take a quarter, and they put the quarter on the table, and they ask the child, is the quarter there? The child will say yes. You put a drinking glass on top of the quarter, and you can see the quarter through the glass. And say it's a quarter there, the child will say yes. You pour water into the glass, and through the refraction of the light, you can't see the quarter. There's a quarter there, the child will say no. Because the child doesn't have object constancy, as Piaget would say. So it's like a game. So you pour the water out, is the quarter there? Yes. Put the empty glass there, they see it, is it there? You pour the water in, is it there? No. You do it over and over as a game. The moment comes when you fill the glass with water and you ask the child, is the quarter there? The child will say yes. The moment the child said yes, the parents tear up, see, because of their love for the child. That's grace. See? Grace is the intimate welling up of a preciousness about something, and you're immensely grateful for it. And there's no way to explain it. You only know you're being asked to be faithful to it. And what a good note to end on, because it's been a grace for me to be here with you today. Really, thank you so much. Thanks.
Before you leave, a couple of announcements. One, if you have one of the hearing devices, we ask that you please return it to the narthex behind the sanctuary so that we'll have them for tomorrow morning. Secondly, Jim, we thank you because, like Teresa, everything you say counts because it comes from your heart, and it touched our hearts. And that's why this gratitude and grace is so heartfelt. Thank you.